small community where we can talk to rural folks about their concerns and our communities of color in the state as well. So I'm really excited to be doing this work. And I have some insights to share with you about why I feel that now more than ever it's a time to really throw down and make something of the work that we're doing at the state level really stick. So I just came from a meeting with Vien Trong, who is the executive director of Green for All. Green for All is an environmental justice powerhouse in San Francisco that was started by Van Jones, as many of you may know. Vien met with us because she wanted to share back some of the things that she's been hearing, some of the meetings that she's been in since the election. She's met with Michael Broome and Bill McKibben. She's had the White House call her or email her basically every day. And the fact of the matter is our leaders are looking for bold action from the states because they realize that they're handcuffed at the federal level. And they realize that they don't even know the depth and breadth of how bad it's going to be. And it's states like Oregon that we're one of six states in the entire country that have a Democratic governor and barely a Democratic majority in our House and Senate at the state legislature, one of six states only. That really means something. So if we, if the White House and President Obama are calling on environmental justice and climate leaders, asking them to look at what states can do, they're talking about Oregon. And she came up here because she wanted that message to really resonate with us that are working. And so I want to bring that message to you. I think that there is a new way of talking about this that we haven't talked about it before. Because it's not just about the climate anymore. It's about creating an economic stability in this country. I mean, I was trying to think about how we can't no longer pretend like all the people that voted for Trump didn't, because they did. And if I work on a nonpartisan issue, then I have to be able to resonate with a lot of people that I might not necessarily feel comfortable having a conversation with. And he, I think, inappropriately connected to some really real things that are happening with people in rural America, in lower and working class America, that haven't really been talked to in a long time, haven't seen investments in their community in a long time, haven't seen anybody reach out and really connect with them. And even if he did so as a false idol, he still did it. It still worked. So I think what we have to remember is that there are people that are desperately looking for answers, not just leadership in the White House, but people in our rural communities and our low-income communities, our communities of color, that will get hit hardest and fastest, of course, which is the irony of it, by all of the dismantling that Trump's administration wants to do to affordable housing, to SNAP, to Head Start, to all the programs that underpin the most vulnerable populations in our country. So I think that if we're fighting for climate, we're fighting for climate justice because we know there's a huge problem in front of us, then we should use it to battle some of other problems that are tied to that and bring forth big solutions. Because if we don't, then it doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't work for the system that we're living in, and it doesn't resonate with the people that we, quite frankly, need it to resonate with if we're going to pass big bills. So it's no longer the time to be kind of ivory tower environmentalists and just care about mountains. We have to care about everybody. And so I think that when we're talking about these bills that we're working on in the Oregon legislature, we're really thinking about economic stability, community investments, investments in renewables, and then protecting our most vulnerable from shouldering the burden of if we are going to put a price on our climate pollution and we are going to move to renewables, making sure that the most vulnerable or low-income people in our community have help from shouldering that burden, that the rest of us really might not feel as we write a check to PGE every month. So that's a little of the big picture that I have before I dive into the more nuts and bolts of it. But I do want to pause for questions along the way, and just raise your hand too if you have questions about some of the things that I'm referencing or you're not quite sure what context we're talking about. So what we are talking about is two bills. There are handouts up here which I didn't print enough because there's so many of you. This is a great problem to have. And so we will spend this time talking about two big policies. One is coming from us as advocates and from the people, and that is a push to hold polluters accountable for their emissions and to provide the necessary money to reinvest in communities and in renewables. So the very, very working term for that campaign right now is the Food Accountability and Community Reinvestment Campaign. I promise we'll come up with a better one. Maybe we can come up with a better one.
Share the printed copies tonight if you can.
Yeah.
And this is the first two things that we'll be emailing to you afterwards.
Immediately afterwards, we'll email. We'll be sure to email both.
And
these are the one changes that have the messages that we want you to carry to your legislators
what?
About how we're talking about these issues. So we'll definitely make sure that everyone has them. So the first thing is
something really.
Corporations get away with polluting the environment and never having to pay for it. And it's an ill that has gone on for far too long since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So one thing that we could very easily, not easily, of course, it's going to be a fight, but one thing we should do is make corporations pay to emit greenhouse gases in the atmosphere immediately. And we should collect that money, and then there's a big question. So I wanted to take a second to talk about what some states are proposing and why we, our table and our coalition are proposing. So first is the cap. Draw a cap like this. This is where we are, 2016. This is all of the emissions, and they're really bad. This is where, let's say this is 2050. This is where we need to go. We need to go to zero emissions. The stuff can't go in the atmosphere the way that it's going. But luckily, there's a lot of things in that time frame that are going to help us get there. Just besides this piece of other technology, there's other policies. There needs to be a suite of policies and technology. We're putting cap on emissions right now. So all of this is greenhouse gases, which I'm somewhat abbreviating by writing GHG. And this is current day. So everything under this would get priced. So that means corporations would have to pay to emit. And then there's the what to do afterwards. So there's a couple ideas, and I want to introduce them because I know that there are groups that work on presenting some other ideas that we have just, that doesn't fit in with our values. And I have a question.
I would just say, corporations must pay for emitting and what kind of electricity, or what other kinds of groups are you thinking
about? That's a great question. So there's the electricity sector, PGE and Sempor, but there's also the transportation sector that emits a lot. Transportation is harder to get at because it's not only the buses and trucks, but it's also our cars. But we do have to put a price on that as well. And then there's the industrial sector, manufacturing, that create their own energy. Sometimes they have on-site energy that they burn in order to fuel creating or whatever processes they have for industry. So that's also, sugar industry is a really big and complicated one in Oregon. That has a massive amount of emissions. Agriculture also, cows, emit a lot of methane and are even trickier to get under the cap. So we could really go in the weeds, but that is a good question because there's a whole pie chart of where all the emissions come from in the state. One number that's good to remember is that in total, Oregon emits 80 metric, I want to get the number right. Okay, 60 million metric tons of greenhouse gases every year. The entire state. 60 million metric tons of greenhouse gases every year.
Yeah.
By comparison, though, California is something like 700 million metric tons.
Yeah, but they're much bigger states.
Yeah, they are a much bigger state, but we have a much smaller thing. Of that, 18 million metric tons is the electricity sector. 18 out of 60, just in Oregon.
Did you say you were paying the
tax? No. So there's different ways of gathering this money. We haven't quite figured out what mechanism we think is the most politically and economically feasible. Most likely what it'll do is it'll chart all of the industries that are emitting in Oregon. And all the ones that are emitting 25, this is kind of going into the weeds, but tell me if it's useful. All of the industry and sources that are emitting over 25,000 million metric tons a year will be 25,000 metric tons a year will be held to the cap standard. So if you're emitting 25,000 metric tons or more, you have to pay to emit. If you're emitting 25,000 metric tons or less, like small farms, like some of the timber operations, like some of you won't be held. We'll talk off. Pat's shaking his head no, because the 25,000 is somewhat of a magic number. It comes from California's already implemented a policies like this, and they went with that number. So that's also something we should talk about setting.
Is this different than a carbon tax?
Yes, it is different than the carbon tax. The carbon tax is structured in that everybody who emits is taxed on it, and then that money gets pooled, and then the state gets to decide what's done with it. The way that this mechanism is going to work is there's an inventory done on everyone of all the corporations and industry that's emitting, and then they get credits that they have to buy in order to emit, and they can trade with each other, or they just are held to a tiered standard and collect the money. It sounds like a tax, but the reason we're ensuring that we're not calling it a tax in Oregon is because in order to pass a tax in the Oregon legislature, you need a 3/5 majority. It's all semantics, really. What we're doing is collecting money for greenhouse gas pollution. But if we call it a tax, then
you
have to be held to
the strictly speaking, because a tax is a fixed price per emission, and cap is only so much that can be emitted. And depending upon how the mechanism is structured, there could be a varying price over time for those.
Exactly. So
this is really cap and trade.
It is cap and trade. But it doesn't have to be a trade. So we'll talk about that. So what we're considering right now is the two most important facets of this you have to remember is that we're capping it and putting a price on it, and then we're investing it. So really it's cap and invest. We could do a trade, but we could also just do a straight fee, which is no trading, but all the corporations have to pay a fee in order to emit. This hand and then that one back there.
I thought DEQ was working on a mechanism already in legislation that passed, studying how to. I thought it was how to, in some of these details, how much would be targeted, how much would be.
They received $250,000 in short session this year to start answering some of those questions, but it's not going to be it's not mandated. I mean, the legislature still has to look at that research and see if that's the direction they want to go. And from what we've heard from Colin McKenna, the person leading the research there, they don't have enough time or money to really do the breadth and depth of the research they need. So they have to report something in February, but they're saying already they don't think it'll be that robust. So
we have other people who are going to do this?
Yes, lots of smart people that are helping with that. The hand back there?
Yeah, so are you going to do the emissions accounting based on the way it's done now, or are you going to go to a pure scientific method?
As to where the cap needs to be and how much we scale down?
How you calculate the emission.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
Did I finish my
comment? No, I finished.
Take natural gas. It has a huge amount of upstream fugitive emissions. Those are currently not counted.
Yeah, that is a flaw, I would say, but it's something that DEQ is also looking at.
I think one of the issues here is, and we have to reference this, is whether we put the cap on suppliers or emitters. There are thousands and thousands of emitters, all of us, but there are only a handful, you know, several dozens of suppliers, and they actually have a better handle of how much fuel they're going to sell. And so, if you put the requirement on suppliers, the accounting and the tracking becomes clearer, and you can certainly include the upstream emissions to supply natural gas in that framework.
To an extent, I'm going to let Rick.
Could I make a process suggestion?
Yes.
Let's assume that Shilpa has a coherent presentation to make. It may well answer your question, and if it doesn't, we can take it at the end. I want to keep on like this.
Yeah.
We'll never get there.
That's true. Okay. So that makes sense. So as I was saying, we're going to cap and price carbon emissions in the state, and then we have proceeds that are generated from that process. And the proceeds We want to invest in renewables and in workforce development to build a just transition. There's a lot of climate impacted industry in Oregon, like the fishing industry, outdoor rec industry, wineries, timber, agriculture, and we need to take into account how we're going to transition those communities to have a place for livable wage jobs in the future. So that's part of it. Part of it is bill assistance for low-income folks in the state, because inevitably utility companies are going to try to pass the cost of implementing this onto ratepayers, and that's going to cause energy bills to go up. The reason that we're structuring it this way hinges on three core values that our coalition has come together on. So our coalition has been working together for 6 months. It represents communities of color, labor, grassroots environmental groups like 350PDX, mainstream climate groups, and public health groups as well, and faith. And before we were talking about any policy, we had a conversation in June where we posed the question, why does your group and your membership care about climate? Why do you care about climate? Why do you care about doing anything on it? And we surfaced a lot of very similar and interesting answers, which is that all of our membership is concerned with what's happening to the planet. And a lot of people feel that the impacts of Oregon are being overseen because Oregon has a stereotype of being a green state. And so people aren't actually thinking about the real impacts of the droughts in eastern and central Oregon, the real impacts of wildfires, what that does for the tourism industry in Hood River and in Bend and other parts of the state. Really wanted swift climate justice-based action. We also surfaced that there are a lot of communities in the state that are desperately in need of investment, whether it's in transportation infrastructure, whether it's in affordable housing, whether it's in job creation and job opportunity. So with a big problem, we have opportunities for big solutions. So that was the other one, is to bring more equity to communities in Oregon. And then the last was we need an entire systems change. The way that we have been operating is what got us here in the first place, and so we need to transition to a clean energy economy, and that's going to take money to do that. So the three core values were help the climate, build in equity, and create a just transition. And from there, we have to cap the stuff, and we should put a price on it so we can generate money to reinvest to get that equity and just transition portion. So that's how we came to have to invest as we are now. So I wanted to pause there for a few more questions before I talk about the transportation package and a little bit about what we're doing with this campaign and session. Mm-hmm. Does anyone have one?
Just double checking. So what you're saying is what you have just described to us is a bill that you hope to have introduced in the legislature this session.
In 2017.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And right now, so that's a great segue. Right now, it's in a campaign proposal. So it's a set of principles we're taking around to senators and representatives. We have Senator Chris Edwards from Eugene, has a long-time environmental champ that's really interested in working with us, and we think will come in on these principles. What we want to ensure is that we did a lot of work and put a lot of thought and research into why we care deeply about adhering to best available science, putting as stringent a cap as we can on as much industry as we can in Oregon, all of these things. And we don't want a legislator that's going to sell us out even before we have to get to the gate. So we're having those tough conversations now, but we hope that it'll be a bill. I'm going to go here and then this way with questions.
I still don't quite understand the difference between a tax and a cap in this instance. You're trying to have them cap their emissions by leveling or levying a tax on by any other name.
So the difference is that in the cap scenario, you cannot go over the cap or you will incur a massive penalty.
Okay.
In the tax, you can just keep emitting as much as you want as long as you pay taxes on it.
Uh-huh.
So it's not turning the bus around.
Okay.
Then I saw some right here, hands.
How do you facilitate equity to people who get that high? How do you figure out who you help out with their electricity bill? What kind of mechanism?
There's a couple of things. We're working with low-income advocates at the federal and state level. things like the Citizens Utility Board, and they have several smart ways of looking at, so it's like 200% on the federal poverty line is everything, 200% of the federal poverty line is, if you're under that, it's all low income. So that's like one parameter, but then it can vary by economic opportunity per county or things like Josephine might have an even lower than Multnomah, things like that. And then what, of course, what rural communities want and what communities of color want, what all those communities want, have been surfaced by actually working with those communities. So I completely claim ignorance on where I was even 2 months ago on this, was saying, oh, this sounds great, we're just gonna, you know, build workforce development plans and everyone's gonna learn how to put up solar panels or whatever. But I will admit, like, it just sounded great. And then I went and actually talked to folks and said, you know, that said, we were in Medford and we were talking to some rural activists down there. And they were saying, yeah, we have a lot of people that are already trained. We don't have the infrastructure of where to put them. So that's the other, I mean, that's, and talking to labor unions also helped us surface that. So we're really learning as we go, but I think we're having important conversations and not making assumptions about, you know, this is going to fix everything or anything like that. So this one and then that one.
So there's no revenues generated unless someone exceeds the cap.
No. Everyone is paying under the cap as well.
Okay.
And if you go over the cap, then it's a massive, really heavy penalty.
People under 25,000 aren't paying.
People under 25,000 are not paying, but there are ways of getting at it. So,
25,000.
Like transportation, like fuel costs, there might be a slight increase in the gas tax to amount for, you know, people driving cars and buses and trucks and things like that. But we're still looking at ways of doing that. Yeah. I have one hand there, and then I'm going to go back there.
I'm just a little confused. Could you reorient? So I know you're from a new Oregon. I don't understand the coalition you're addressing. So
yeah.
Are you just interviewing these groups, or is there actually an organization that's part of this campaign that includes labor and these other groups that you're mentioning?
Renew is that hub. So Renew has an executive committee of Sierra Club, OLCD, OEC, and Climate Solutions. And then our table.
Can you say the acronym?
Yeah, Oregon Environmental Council, Sierra Club, Oregon League of Conservation Voters, and Climate Solutions. That's our executive committee. And then our close partners that have been working with us for several months now, AFL-CIO and Building Trades and the Oregon Nurses Association have been at every meeting, on conference calls on a weekly basis. Those are our labor folks, and we're bringing in more labor allies. We have a labor organizer. Our strongest equity partners that are, again, like daily, weekly meetings with is APANO, Coalition of Communities of Color, and all of their affiliates. So that's both African American Leadership Forum, IRCO, Immigration Refugee, Coalition of Oregon, Beyond Toxics, OPAL Environmental Justice, Latino Network, and Verde. Those are our strongest equity folks. Grassroots is 350 in Portland, 350 Salem, 350 Deschutes, Rogue Climate in Southern Oregon, SOCAN, Southern Oregon Climate Action Network, Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, and a couple other grassroots environmental. That's the working, and it's not, I think it's mischaracterized by calling it a coalition, because a coalition has like a paper that they signed, and this is what we're going to win, and this is how much money we put into that. We are not that. We're just a table that is operating from values we created criteria for policy selection, that created a principles doc, and now I'm here today talking to people about it. That's how it came to be. Very organic.
Are you putting out a newsletter or anything like that?
Yeah, so Renew will start sending updates that will be most likely echoed by Sierra Club, OLCB, and 350PDX, since they're partners in our work. We'll start sending out volunteer updates. If you sign up to be a volunteer with Renew, you'll get updates. You can just go to our website and fill out the volunteer form. Our broader list is 45,000 people, so I probably won't be getting updates at such a granular level to everybody, but if you sign up as a volunteer, you'll get updates from me. Yeah. I saw a hand right there.
Are those entities below the line that don't pay taxes, are they capped?
Yes. So if you're a smaller emitter and you're below the line, you're still paying. But as long as you're below the cap and you're paying, you're in compliance. I don't think I understood the question.
I think there's further questions on the mechanism.
Yeah.
Everything below the cap has to have an allowance of payment.
Right. That's true.
The cap is steadily declining over time.
Ultimately
end up reaching zero. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you have to start picking up lower scale emitters to keep moving that down. Okay. So it's starting out at 25,000. Probably will remain there for a while, but eventually those folks will have to be covered as well.
Mm-hmm.
By some mechanism, the cap and invest isn't the only way you reduce emissions. You can have complementary regulatory mechanisms as well.
I'm going to take just two more questions on this before we launch into the transportation policy, if anyone has any.
This may be a deeper question we want to get into. How do you see this as being different from what we hear as paying dividends?
Great question. Great question. So the question was, how is this different from fee and dividend? So in fee and dividend, there's still everyone under IS. I actually don't know if fee and dividend advocates for a cap, but everybody pays.
Okay.
So everybody pays to admit. That's the fee portion. I'm just going to write cap on the desk. But the dividend part is, instead of creating this pot and allocating it to these resources, to these destinations, every household gets a check. That's how you make up for the increase in electricity bill and potentially, you know, anything, transportation costs, whatever they may be. Everybody gets a check maybe twice a year, every quarter. It's per household, which is, I'm just going to say it. I think it's a little paternalistic. I think that we've heard from equity partners at the national and local level that, and from low-income advocates and rural advocates, that what's needed is big investments. That they don't feel comfortable with the idea of the government deciding what a household looks like and who gets a check. That it might not be the person that receives the check that actually pays all the bills. And there are a lot of renters, and if the landlord pockets it because it comes to an address and then the renter doesn't see it, there's a ton of problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is, we have a lot of burgeoning problems in our communities that need big investments right now, whether it's transportation infrastructure, whatever it may be. And allocating it out to every family in America, regardless of their income level, misses a boat on that. So,
makes sense.
One other thing is a little simpler, that is, it's on the producers, the extractors, so it's far fewer of those who pull the fuel out of the ground. They're the ones that get administered.
It depends on the way it's not always like that.
That's what the National Citizens Climate Lobby people have been talking for years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's essentially zero extraction in Oregon.
Yeah, so then we put down the money in the state again. I'm going to take the hair here.
In this scenario, does everybody pay the same rate? How is the structure?
That is a great question. So if we were to do, getting a little complicated, but the answer is no. If you emit more, you pay more. And if you emit less, you pay less. So, but you can even have, like, the way that we talked about a cap and fee without doing a trade, is having tier one, tier two, tier three. So tier three is a cement plant in Central Oregon that just emits a ton of greenhouse gases. They're going to have to pay more. Tier two, but they have an opportunity if they reduce their emissions to bump into tier two, and then they get to pay less.
Yeah, because
so it's further incentive.
It's still on volume. It's based on volume. It's not a separate pricing structure for carbon emitted.
It is based on volume, but it is a separate price for each category. All right, I'm going to move on to transportation because Raphael is going to talk about it a little bit, like the legislature and a little bit of that too. Okay, so we have Kate Brown as governor for two more years, hopefully two more years after that. But one of the things that Governor Brown wants to work on is a transportation package, which is a policy that has been met with some skepticism early on from climate and equity advocates. But we see that if we are advocating strongly on it, then there's an opportunity for climate and equity wins from it. Basically, wants to raise the gas tax a little bit to create a lot of money if it was to go the wrong way, just build a ton of new roads and bridges. What we're advocating for, and that's not climate sensitive at all, and actually doesn't improve congestion. You know, there's been multiple studies that show if you build more roads and just more people pull their cars out of their two-car garages and pile on the roads, so it doesn't really make a difference. We're joining a coalition called Transportation for Oregon's Future. It has a lot of active transportation, bike, pedestrian, public transit advocates on it, as well as rural advocates. And there are things in here that we feel pretty strongly about. One is simply that we need to fix the roads and bridges that we have that are in decrepit condition instead of building new ones. So, you know, if this gas tax money can only be spent a certain way, then we're going to advocate for it to fix what we have instead of building new things. Invest in public transit, that's pretty much a no-brainer. And then make our streets safer. So there's a couple of things on here. The reason that I wanted to bring it up is because while this is what we feel should rule the day, and we should, as climate and equity and people that care about our communities, should be talking about this tirelessly, this is invariably going to take up all the air in the room. And, you know, because it's coming from Governor Brown, legislators, Speaker Pro Tem, President Peter Courtney of the Senate are going to be intent on trying to move this through. So I feel like it's only fair to bring up both.
I just wanted to say or ask, gas taxes are going to be really hard out in the world. People, how are you going to convince them on that?
Yeah, that's a great point. And a lot of Republican legislators that represent rural communities in the state are already opposed to this before it's even left the gate. So there have to be, you know, compromises that are made. I'm not too intimately familiar with what that's looking like, but it does have a much greater impact on rural communities than it does on urban. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about what the campaign for this looks like right before we break into groups, but next I'm going to hand it over to Rafaela for a presentation on lobbying itself.
I think we're actually going to just allow people to have a 5-minute break
before
switching gears into lobbying training. So if you want to run to the bathroom or ask any other questions, ask more questions, yeah, we'll just take about 5 to 10 minutes and then we'll switch gears.
This stuff gives me a headache.
Just trying to concentrate.
You live in Washington County by chance?
No,
okay.
Much more.
Yeah, Washington County is doing an online survey of what people want to have done for transportation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's an interesting survey. Also, so often those surveys try to give you the answer that they want.
Yeah, that's the trouble with this. They phrase the questions in such a way that you might not need the answer.
But they actually have a fair number of 8 or so places where you can tell them what you think. I like that.
Well, that's great. Yeah. It's not often that you have that opportunity.
Right. There've been a few questionnaires that people send often or sit with the, and since we care, give us money. But I've often opened up a survey, taken a quick look at it, and closed it, and then written back to them and told them what I thought of their survey.
Yeah. You know, same here, I open a lot of them. No, I won't answer.
Occasionally, I'll do something like
what
a,
I think.
A screen capture and then write, you know, give them an essay answer.
So what is it with what they're looking for there, or what direction they're going?
Well, they've got the West Side connector on the list again, and so that's one of the things they're after. It's sort of a can we make you happy with a combination of some better Macs and bus service, and then what are we really doing in the future to get rid of carbon? And they point out that they expect driverless vehicles to be.
I think you push that. I don't trust them. I
don't either, but they're coming.
The technology companies are all pushing it. They think it's going to be a better thing. I'm not even saying that. That's true.
Well, what? The problem that I see is there are two problems. One of them is the one that he mentioned, that if you build roads, people will come. And I really do not believe in putting roads into rural areas that you want to stay rural. You know, putting a road there is committing to have it become urban.
Yeah. Or unless you have a gravel road or something like that. You know,
well,
or maybe you're really a very unimproved road.
Or the other way is you elevate the road and you don't give it entrance and access. It's just where you want
it. George gets a drive-by. You got to go with a couple of things. Much more extensive and much more frequent.
What do you do about the last mile?
About the last mile.
I mean, anytime I can, if where I'm going is within a few blocks of the Mac, I'll drive to the Mac and take the Mac. You know, I'm from Beaverton, you know, because that city can get me either east or west of Beaverton and can place me in a lot of good places. But there's a lot of places that don't get close enough.
Yeah. You know, like connected buses, you know, you have to get off here and it should be from there, buses dispersing.
Well, it's that kind of thing that you kind of want an awfully affordable Uber-like connectivity, I think, at the other end. What's that going to be?
I've never taken an Uber, so I don't know.
I haven't either, but there's
this
cab that you can call, and they're flexible.
I don't know these people.
Hi, everyone. So we're going to switch gears a little bit. My name is Raphaella. I'm an organizer of the
Somewhere
Between
My Day.
And my counterpart, other organizer with LTV, James, was supposed to be here with me. He couldn't make it tonight. He actually, the two of us, plus we have one organizer who's currently located in Deschutes County, and Ben, he actually is in charge of Multnomah County, along with a few others. I work primarily, we both work out of the Portland office. I work in Washington, Lincoln, and Lane counties. So okay. I think in the follow-up email that we'll send all of you after tonight, I'm just going to include, we'll have all of our contact information. I'm going to include James's information as well, for those of you who, I assume most of you are in Multnomah County, and he would be a great point person. He's done some lobbying with me, so if you want to connect with him, I would definitely encourage that. First, also, I just want to thank everyone for the enthusiasm and just for being here. I think it's been pretty clear to me. I've slowly started to become a little bit more optimistic about things, especially seeing how much energy and drive and commitment towards getting involved that I've seen across all demographics in the past week, and I think we can really harness that and put it to good work. So just thank you for being here and, you know, crawling out of the week-long depression that I've fallen in.
But, I haven't gotten all the way
out. So we're going to talk a little bit about meeting with legislators. So quickly, can I just get a show of hands? Has anyone met with a legislator before? Okay, so you guys actually probably have more experience than I do. I don't have extensive training. James and I did some lobbying on Capitol Hill earlier this summer, and we've gone to a few different trainings about kind of best practices. So this might be common knowledge to all of you. If at any point anyone wants to interject, I definitely think that you all probably have a lot more to contribute, so feel free to raise a hand and if you want to contribute at any point. But since there are some of you who have not experienced this and may not, you know, be as familiarized with the ins and outs of the Oregon legal system, we're just going to kind of do some basic overview to get us started. So basic makeup, so what's important to know. Did retain our majority in the House and
Senate. 10 Democrats, 14 Republicans.
The House has
35 Democrats, 25 Republicans. And Kate Brown,
Representative.
Environmental makeup.
Can you repeat that slide a little bit more?
Yeah.
What's environmental makeup? 16 pro-green votes, so essentially environmental votes, which is obviously something that I guess I should also maybe mention, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with the Oregon League of Conservation Voters, but just to put it out there, we essentially are the political arm of the environmental movement, and we work to elect leaders throughout the Oregon legislature who will be climate champions, environmental champions, and will promote a conservation agenda and maintain our environmental legacy in Oregon. We are nonpartisan, so we vet candidates who are running at every level. We interview them, we decide who to endorse, and then the committee members who are in each of the counties that we work in, they're the ones who actually get to decide who to endorse after the interview process. And then during election season, we pick a couple of contested races and really put all of our efforts towards campaigning for those candidates. So that's kind of the process that we just came off the hills of, and kind of a little bit the work that we do. So obviously if there, you know, is a Republican candidate who's great on the environment, that is the lens through which we see everything. So we, you know, in the past have done dual endorsements, which, you know, obviously can be controversial, where we'll endorse both a Republican and a Democrat candidate. And that can be tough, but, you know, if they hold true to our values, then that's what we go after. So Senate leadership, Senate President Peter Courtney, Majority Leader Jamie Burdick, we're just doing some name recognition, and Minority Leader Ted Lilly, we can kind of go Jamie Burdick, Majority Leader, Democrat, and then Ted Theriault, Republican. Does anyone have those names? House leadership, so Speaker of the House, Tina Kotek, Democrat, the Majority Leader, Jennifer Williamson, also a Democrat, and the Minority Leader, Mike McClain, Republican. James was really excited about going through this with all of you. I In the interest of time, I'm going to focus more on lobbying best practices, but if any of you want to look, we have a more simplified version here, and then the next slide is a little bit expanded version of just the process by which a bill becomes a law. And if any of you are interested in that, I'd be happy to walk you through it, talk to you about it after, and look at the slide. But I think for now, we're just going to go ahead to the next slide. Yeah, actually, the title of that slide,
we can make it available after, right?
We can also send a PDF, yeah. That slide, it said like a simple walkthrough, but it obviously looks pretty complex. So we're going to focus right now, turn our attention to why all of you matter as constituents, as engaged citizens who are compelled to act right now, compelled to get involved, and what you can do to kind of put that energy towards good use. Obviously, a lot of you already know the value of speaking with your legislators and the potential benefits that we can get from doing that. But you do have a special role as constituents. Legislators want to hear from you. Legislators want to know who their constituents are, what their values are, what their needs are, what their desires are. So, if there is any trace of doubt, don't doubt that your legislator does care and wants to be hearing about the things that you wish to happen. No matter how you get in touch, they will hear you, and if you want to listen to you, there are several ways to get in touch. Obviously, not everyone has the time, resources, desire to set up a meeting or a one-on-one, but phone calls, emails, these are all different ways that you can reach out and at least kind of establish connection. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. So we think that, in-person visits are the best, are the most influential. I think, probably we can all agree that the most powerful conversations are in person, when you can have more of a dialogue rather than over email. And sometimes, you can imagine the number of emails that, any legislator or their staffers receive. It's hard to sort through those and thoughtfully respond to each one. So meeting in person is just a good way also to show your face. If you're, especially for someone who's interested in politics and staying involved in other ways. If you want to have a longer conversation, we're going to talk about kind of just being prepared to be adaptable with time. But before or after session is ideal in terms of just wanting to ensure that you have the time allotted, that you, enough time to get across the message that you want to convey. Personalized emails, handwritten letters, these are all great ways to reach out. And it's just important to keep in mind that staff, we, want to treat them with respect. They often will be more than willing to listen to you, to, let you voice your concerns, but we don't want to necessarily engage in arguments or kind of, provoke them or kind of be antagonistic in any way. So I think just generally being mindful of the way in which you present yourself and the way in which you conduct yourself, because in some ways, going in up for one-on-one, you're, a representative of perhaps the environmental movement. I don't, want to speak for, what movement or group or demographic anyone identifies with, but in some ways, you're representing, you're speaking up for probably a lot of different people who share your beliefs, so we just want to kind of be respectful in that way.
When you say handwritten letters, what's the difference between that and email?
An actual handwritten letter.
Okay, I just want to make sure you were including email.
Handwritten letters, emails, and I guess just kind of the mode of communication that you prefer.
I do have a note on that, having worked with the legislature before. They get a lot of draft emails that are generated from like Nation Builder and MailChimp and all those things, so people have lists of, Renew Oregon will say, send an email to your legislator, create a form email, and plug it away into their inboxes, and then we get a nasty call that says, we just got 600 emails from the district, and they all look exactly the same, and we were deleting them all, and we hate you now, and don't want to talk to you about this issue. So that's why the handwritten letter makes a huge difference.
Right.
By snail mail, shows up at their office, they have to open it up and read it, it goes a long way. Even if it says the same, okay.
And I assume handwritten doesn't necessarily mean handwritten.
It could be typed and signed at the bottom, but mailed in makes a big difference. Personalized emails are great too, but they are very tired of the form emails.
Yeah.
phone call.
I just wanted to point out how effective a letter, in my own experience, a handwritten letter can be. When Kate Brown first went into office, she almost immediately continued the moratorium on the death penalty that Kitzhaber had put in. And I was very pleased with that. I sent her a letter, and I received a handwritten response within a week. So, they do notice.
Obviously, on the circumstance on the legislator, on the time of year, but...
Sure.
I have a question. One thing I've heard is whenever you go to see a legislator, you should always have something you're specifically asking for.
Absolutely.
But my actual question is, how often personal visits, how often do you need to go in order to get a legislation to actually start remembering?
I guess that depends on what kind of relationship you are aiming towards with the legislator, if you want them to know you personally and continue a working relationship. That depends on your motive behind the meeting. And to your first point, we will be talking more about kind of what to include in your reading, what tangible items you want to have prepared, and how to go about that. So we can next slide. So in terms of just logistics of setting up a meeting, part of what we did when we had you all come in is look up your legislator, and what I think we're going to do at the end is just have everybody go around and it's going to probably take a few minutes, but and just stand up, say who your legislator is, maybe say who you are, just so that you all can see who the other people in the room are that you potentially would be forming a coalition with, going into a meeting with, wanting to collaborate in some way. And, obviously some of you might just want to work independently, but I think that you should take advantage of this opportunity that we're all in the same room and there might be some room for collaboration. So we're going to do that at the end. But the first step is obviously to identify your targeted legislator. And a lot of people don't know, the House district they live in. Yeah.
Could we get in groups as we see who has the same legislators?
Yeah, so we wanted to plan a breakout session, and I kind of wanted to just see when we're done with this, what you all were interested in doing. We could potentially use the hall out here, do some small groups in here. I know we're a large group, but it's a pretty small room.
There's at least a couple of other rooms that are open as well.
Yeah, but I think that would be helpful, just since you're all here right now. We might as well, exchange contact information, and if, those of you who are motivated and ready to go, it might be a good opportunity to link up with others who are like-minded. Yes.
Are you taking the lobby day?
We will be. So we will be working on Lobby Day in February, and there's going to be plenty of outreach and preparation before that. So we will also be talking about that.
Yeah.
Listen,
ladies, I'd like to hear from people who are
not. I would say that it depends on the issue.
But, maybe Jennifer Williams, maybe not so much. It just depends. I would say start with people in your district unless there's a really imminent need,
Sorry,
did
you say they have to
take the meeting? I mean, they have a responsibility to every citizen in Oregon as a...
So
who's
flooded them with meeting requests?
That probably wouldn't be the most effective because they wouldn't know where to prioritize.
Right.
So
it's not like they have. They're not obligated to do it.
They're more obligated to do it a few of the
constituents. Yeah, they'll probably, all the requests are coming in on one bill. They'll probably contact one of our lobbyists or advocates and say, what's going on? And maybe we can have 20 people come in, 15 people come in at once, or something like that. They'll try to see everyone.
So
it's easier to get meetings than before session. What session starts is difficult to get meetings. You are going to be getting meetings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You say session as in legislative session. A month kind of time? Legislative session meeting when they're all in Salem during the year.
Okay.
So which in 2017 will be February to June. So all be in Salem. We might have to take questions at the end.
Yeah.
We should get through the presentation first.
So in terms of setting up a meeting, which you know might be something that we get started on, some of you get started on tonight, just a few clear steps to identifying your legislator, working with the group, obviously finding a time that works for everybody who at least wants to be present. Some people might just want to kind of brainstorm and make sure that their concerns are voiced. And then it's helpful to have one person kind of be the point person, the contact person, just in terms of organization. I mean, obviously you all have busy lives and live in different places. So I think, you know, if there are groups of you that want to get started tonight, just maybe putting one person in charge of kind of facilitating group communication and scheduling would be helpful. So it's not always clear how much time you're going to have with your legislator. And honestly, sometimes you're going to walk into that room, they're going to say, I have 15 minutes. They're coming in from a meeting late. They have a meeting right after you, and you're just going to have 5 minutes, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do about that. So that, because of that, it's just extremely important to be adaptable and to be ready to give the one-minute version of your pitch, to give the five-minute version of your pitch, to have, you know, it's helpful to have clear speaking roles kind of delegated within your group, just so everyone knows, like, this is what I'm talking about and this is what I'm talking about. But it might also be helpful for everyone kind of to be well-versed in all of it. So just in case something goes wrong and someone's sick and you can still execute what you had planned. So I think just being adaptable and, you know, being respectful of their time and being able to, you know, sell whatever you're, you know, kind of be able to kind of say you're asked in any given amount of time. So that's going to take some practice. And I, you know, it looks like a lot of you have done that before. But once you kind of do develop a working relationship with the people that you are potentially going to be lobbying with, it would be helpful to kind of practice doing it quickly, practice doing it with a longer period of time, things like that. You know, kind of just generally being respectful, being nice, being concise, not including information that isn't pertinent, necessary, just being respectful of their time. And making sure, you know, for your own sake, you have a very small allotted amount of time, and you want to make sure that everything you're saying is what you want to convey. You don't want to get sidetracked on other things. So that's just kind of, you know, you want to make sure you refine your message and your ask before going into the meeting. And be prepared. You don't have to be an expert. If your legislator, I know that, you know, it might be scary. What if you get into the meeting and your legislator asks you, so what about X, Y, and Z, or what about this, what implication is this going to have? And you know, they want to follow up on something and you don't know the answer. It's best to say you don't know and you're going to immediately put them in touch with someone who does know or get back to them with an answer. We don't obviously want to make up anything on the spot or just use conjecture.
Really,
we want to,
really,
you know, shy away from doing that for obvious
idea.
Reasons. So it's not a weakness to say, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to put you in touch with my boss. I'm going to check in with my boss and get back to you. There are numerous ways to, you know, get back to them with the correct information. So don't be afraid of that. You know, don't let that kind of hinder you in the process. So, yeah, that's just kind of some of the tips of going into the meeting. And I think there might be so then follow-up. We don't want to leave the meeting and just kind of, you know, be okay, job was done. I mean, maybe you leave feeling extremely satisfied and you know, accomplished your goal. But usually, you know, the meeting is kind of to make them aware of a concern of yours and of a need to kind of get to work on a certain issue or a certain bill or a ballot measure. So we want to follow up, sending, you know, again, in whatever form of communication you choose, sending an email or a handwritten thank you, just to A, be polite, and B, to keep up the connection. If it is a connection that you want to pursue, it's best to just keep engaging them and, you know, making your face known and letting them know that you're not just, you know, giving up on the cause. You're going to continue to work on this and stay involved. Attending a town hall, testifying at a town hall, these are all other supplemental ways that you can, you know, continue to make your voice heard, make the environmental community's voice heard, and just show your face and show that you're persistent. If you write an email down the road, you can mention your visit to Salem. Always helpful to include any and all relevant experience, just when, you know, kind of talking about the work that you're doing. Engaging campaigns is another way to stay involved. And just kind of, you know, big picture relationships do matter. Your legislator very well might remember you, might remember your meeting in particular.
And I'm not sure if there's another slide I wanted to mention. If there's not, I wanted to also just talk about the power of creating a narrative or a story. I've gone to several workshops. I actually just came from one today at the State Environmental Leaders Conference about how powerful stories can be in a whole host of situations. But especially, you know, if you have an elevator pitch to deliver in 2 minutes, and you're, say you're, you know, you're in a room with your legislator, it's really helpful to have, not that, you know, when I first started going to these trainings, I was like, what if I don't have a compelling story? Like, what if nothing, pivotal moment happened in my career where something terrible happened and then, boom, I was, you know, motivated to pursue what I'm doing now. It doesn't necessarily have to be that kind of story. It can be a story that you have heard about somebody else. It can be about someone that you've worked with. It can really take any shape or form. But I think just keeping in mind, and, you know, this could take up a whole other session of kind of crafting narratives, crafting stories, and thinking about how to compellingly convey a message and convince your legislator or whomever you're talking to why the issue that you're talking about is important and why it should matter to them.
Yeah. Can I get a quick example of that?
Yeah.
But sometimes the way that you connect or your story is as simple as, I grew up going to Black Butte every summer, and I'm worried that I won't be able to take my grandchildren there because of the forest fires that are happening every summer now. It's something that tangible and quick, or it's I grew up here and I never remember it being this warm on a day like today. Even as simple as that. But something to bring the human element of what we're doing is really helpful.
Right, and I've heard stories that range from, you know, people who have cancer and are worried about toxic pollutants in their environment. I've heard stories, really influential person in their life, a family member, a loved one, or a professor said something or gave them a book, and that kind of changed their whole perspective. It can be tied to the way that their family or their community has traditionally made a living. It can really, you know, again, take any way, shape, or form, and you can have many stories on hand. I think it's good to think of a bunch of different stories, when you're meeting with your legislator, what story might be most effective in this situation. So I just kind of wanted to put that out there. We're not going to do like a storytelling workshop now, but I think what would maybe be, I don't know if you want to do the naming of legislators now and then break up.
We can get questions first, I think.
Yeah.
You were just talking about meeting directly with the legislator. Could you also talk about the benefits then about meeting with staff or is that?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's safe to say that speaking up for your values or the environmental community at any level with anybody who you think might be able to, first of all, might just want to hear your story and might be able to do something about your concerns. There's always, always there's inherent value in doing that. I mean, we know even just sharing amongst ourselves and we consider ourselves all, you know, kind of on the same side, that's helpful. We learn from each other. So I think, say you can't book a meeting with your legislator, but you can book a meeting with one of their staffers, that still can, you know, create a lot of positive change. And you never know who they're going to then relay your story to. So I guess I would just say, you know, don't necessarily fixate on having to meet with your legislator one-on-one. There are a lot of ways that you can still...
This is along those same lines. I've been reading that, at least at the federal level, a phone call is effective way to lobby legislatures, and I wondered if you felt that was true at the state level also.
A phone call that the staff has to pick up with
them. Yeah, and it's, I think phone calls are particularly effective before a vote.
Yeah.
So, like, we have your emails, and, you know, we'll have, Rafaela's colleague will be in Salem. We won't be in Salem as organizers, but we'll have a lobbyist there that says, we're not feeling great about Jennifer Williamson. You know, I talked to her this morning when I saw her in the elevator, and she tried to blow me off, and I think she might vote no. Then we send out an email or do a phone tree or a text tree, and we say we need as many calls into our office as possible. That's when I think it makes a really big difference in that fast way, because you're not going to get a meeting till the last minute. She's going to try to be avoiding her constituents. So we're going to be just get her staffers on the phone. Her staffers will grab her before she leaves to lunch and say, hey, I'm being harangued, you know? And it makes a big difference. I think phone calls and building that personal relationship is great.
And also, don't underestimate the power of the staffers. The staffers have a lot of control power. Get to know them.
Yeah.
That's fun. Be an expert for them. Give them things that are helpful to understand the issue.
Yeah, I worked on a fracking ban bill in Maryland last year, and in many offices, the staffers were more excited about passing that bill than the legislators because they didn't have to run for re-election. And they said, yeah, we need this. So
that makes sense.
You know, like the one-pagers, the fact sheets, all that stuff was really helpful.
I don't know if this point's been made, but you don't have to go to Salem to meet with them. You can meet with them here
in their local office.
In their local office, or their staffers would be in the local office if they're in Salem. And
To add to that, many legislators have like a monthly coffee thing that you can just show up for. So you want to get on their email list, find out about when those are, and you can do that by emailing them.
Yeah, I think all representatives, legislators tend to have at least a regular copy.
Yeah, the staffers are really important because they're the ones that get the information to give to the Congress people, and so the Congress people depend on the staffers for their information. Yeah.
Can you also get through to the governor? And as she holds monthly meetings, I've tried to call her office numerous times, and I can never get a human being.
That's a little harder. If you figure that one out, let us know.
Yeah. All right. You know, I'm a little confused still on that. I had understood that our state legislators didn't have local offices.
They don't have like a physical office.
I understand about coffees, but
yeah, there are very few that have a physical office.
Okay.
What Raphael referred to were town halls and coffees. But you know, I think you'll find that your legislator is willing to meet with you probably at their favorite coffee house near their office. And that's how they deal with the out-of-session in Portland meeting.
Any other questions?
Can we do a little primer on what our goals are of these meetings coming up? Like a little bit, we didn't quite touch on that. So we've thrown a lot of information at you, but one of the things that was in Raphael's training is that you go in and you be concise and you have one thing that you want to convey, whether it's please read this fact sheet or whatever it might be, it's one thing that you want to convey. What we want to convey to legislators, and we have a list of facts about this, is that climate impacts are happening in Oregon. It's not the same green, climate-neutral state that some might think it is. We're experiencing fallout on the shore with our crabbing industry, with our oyster and mussel industry. Wildfires are laying waste to much of central and eastern Oregon. Our ranchers are already feeling it. And legislators, particularly in the Portland metro area, are already typecast as liberal and on board with these issues. So giving them these kinds of facts really provides the support that they need in order to fight for climate policy. Because it's, you know, it's kind of like, of course they're going to support climate policy, but we want to help them understand why now and why here. So start with talking about the impacts. I found that to be very useful. And then go into talking about the Polluter Accountability and Community Reinvestment Act. And when we send this out, we're going to have three messaging points that we want to convey to make it really simple, so you're not just reading off of this and feeling like you have to draw messages out of this because it's still, you know, still a very wonky policy. So when we send that out, we'll have the top three bullets that we want to convey. And a lot of that will have to do with what I said. Oregon needs to be a leader. We have the opportunity to solve a really big problem with some really great solutions for our state. And really make the legislator feel like they're doing the right thing, that they're emboldened to make the right decision. It's going to be a feather in their cap if it passes. They're going to feel really special. And so I just want to help wrap up your presentation by saying that's really what we're trying to get at with this lobbying training. We're helping pulling you in Salem and in Bend and Southern Oregon. We want our legislators to start hearing about impacts, and we want them to see this as a solution.
Thank you. I just want to add two things quickly. It is helpful to bring handouts to these meetings. So if you're talking about, you know, if you have 2 minutes to describe an issue and say you're talking about lead contamination in water, and you're not going to get into the details then, you don't necessarily know how well-versed they are in that issue, it's helpful to have a handout and be just, you know, just to offer it here. By the way, if you want to do some more reading, just to be prepared.
You should always have a material to leave.
Yeah.
Always. So it should be this. Or another fact.
I'm confused about soon, hopefully, there's going to be a bill with more particulars about how to work with Jackson. And that would be an obvious time to go and lobby the ladies, of course, are still. Are you suggesting that we should be meeting with our legislators before that and saying there's going to be a bill?
I would say yes, absolutely. Yeah. I would say actually you want to meet with your legislator before you have an ask for them, to build a relationship with them, get to know about what they care about, and you know, then you can come to, I mean, but you can also just go first with a very clear ask.
You can all,
and in fact, shake his hand.
Yeah, and sometimes some legislators, particularly Democrats and progressive legislators, are more motivated to know that a massive table of all these exciting constituencies are on board with the campaign, rather than this is a bill number, you have to pass this bill, you have to pass this bill. You know, maybe it could be recruiting for them as well to hear the names of the groups that are working on this, hear all the constituencies across the state, hear the values behind it. So absolutely, we want to talk, we want to start talking about the campaign with legislators. Here and then, back there.
I know that both of my legislators are leaders. I have women to the board. How can I get them, I need for them not just to be supporting the things, they need to be champions. What is it that you can do to draw that out of the way of
this? That's a great question.
I don't know, just off the top of my head, I don't think there's any one argument that one person can present, but it's the volume of what they're hearing from a number of constituents, all thematically similar. You know, at this point, we don't have a bill to refer to, but we have the principles that Shilpa referred to of, you know, rapidly reducing greenhouse gas emissions, dealing with equity, dealing with reinvestment. There have been two bills in the previous legislatures that I think we all supported, cap and invest bills. The new one will be, in some sense, conceptually similar, hopefully improved in some important respects. You could refer to those and say that you're looking for something, expecting something in the next session that will build on that, and certainly hope that he or she will be supporting and working hard to make sure it moves through the legislature. You know, someone like Williamson, I met with her a year and a half ago or something, and her message was basically, go talk to the Senate. She's great. She's never going to be somebody like Shilpa chose that we got an emergency call. She's going to do the wrong thing. She's almost certain not to. But she's in the leadership position. She could be talking to the President of the Senate, she could be talking to Judy Burdick and saying, we need that damn bill out of the Senate and into the House. And then, as she said, our caucus has its act together. We'll get it out of the House. Mm-hmm. But not just passively kind of sitting there in the House and saying, well, I hope they get it, doing, but actively using the power of their position to work as the extent that they can in the ways that they can with the Senate to get the bill out.
Ambitiously. Power mapping is looking at every person in the House and Senate and then rating them on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 being they're completely with us, we'll 100% vote for the bill, and 5 being we're never ever going to get them. Most people fall in a 2 to 4 category without having talked to them, except for people like Alyssa Kenny Geyer that we know will vote for climate bills no matter what. So power mapping is seeing all the ones that we have, and then seeing the makeup of the chunk of votes that we need to pass the bill. So if we have 16 and we need four more, who are the four that we're going to get? So who are the twos and threes? And then power mapping, the next step is, how do we go deeper and learn about those people to see what motivates them? Where did they go to undergrad? Who can we get to talk to? Who's their alum? You know, things like that.
Who's actually doing the power mapping?
Well, one of the ideas is when we get into groups that you talk about doing that together.
But you would want to redundantly do it. Like, if the building that you're discussing,
we're doing it,
I mean, how is that information shared?
I mean, There's a lot more. Okay, let's see if anybody's got one.
So what we're going to do right now, we're going to break out into groups based on who your house is.
I'm going to read the number of the names of the members.
Get to know each other. So share your name and why you're here. On the back of the sheet, you can write your contact info. Designate a chair or a coordinator. You'll find there's one person that's going to at least just type up everybody's email addresses and get you all in touch with each other. And then that coordinator should also come back and tell us who they are so that we can follow up with you. So put your contact info on here. And then if you get through all of that, you can talk about what you know about the legislator and why you're excited about climate policy and that kind of thing. But we're going to take just 10 minutes. We're going to call it 10 minutes to do this. Okay, so 42 is Rob Knopf. He's a good climate champ. Okay, raise your hand. So we have Judy. Judy here, but look for Judy, and Judy will hold the sign for you out in the hallway. Ken Powell, 34. Okay, so we have Inger. Anybody else? Inger here.
Inger's in, so it might not be over here.
I'm going to be all that. I'm going to be all that.
Well, you're all done.
Hi, pretty good. Oh, no, I'll speak up for another carrot.
Oh, okay. Pretty
good.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I think it's illustrating.
Yeah, great idea.
So,
I think
it's
really
nice.
So, yeah.
Is that just a people on the internet? Is it basically like
Well, we have a group of well, we just have a brand fresh new one because we live in what has been by Reese District. And of course, he's moving on to the treasure. I've been there for so long that I don't know that we ever had another one.
Yeah. Because he gets elected to his job.
No, he didn't. He's the one that lost out to the guy that ran for governor for the Republican last time.
Oh, he lost out to the Republican guy. Yeah. He was put out of the account.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
Are you wanting to
write a back in there? What are you talking about? I'm talking about the guy that got Tobias's the job he wanted, the treasurer. Oh, I haven't heard that piece. So he lost.
Richardson?
Oh, Dennis Richardson? Oh, God. The thing that I went to look for all the official information about who was our representative. That's why it's still listed. Okay, well, he is, because of course, technically she would not take office until December. But that isn't going to make any difference because he won't be the one in the session. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so this is the gal that replaced him. Because
oh, I know her.
She
doesn't
go
into office until after the first year. Okay. I met her. She's actually very supportive for education and women's rights.
Oh, and she on her list of stuff, climate stuff was right there. So
I liked her love when I met her.
Okay, well that's great. But
no, actually,
question. When you've got an outgoing person who's still officially it until December,
don't
but
worry
that doesn't
about
really
him.
Yeah.
No, maybe
but
they're new.
How do you get a hold of the new one?
Good question.
I'll bet I can track that.
There's probably an email address online. You know, you probably can Google and find it. There, you know, they might have a campaign website or something.
Well, they okay, I'm trying to see if there's a campaign address.
They probably don't have their official state email address yet, right. But there's got to be some way to get a hold of
them. Between that said, we can find it.
Yeah, you're smart.
We can find something. We'll find it. OLSB meetings.
Oh.
But
she was running, and I gave her some
of the dollars. Who did? Who? Sherry?
Sherry.
Oh, cool. Okay. So,
anyway, we got to get started, and I don't want to wait until January to start.
Yeah, it's already
coming
around. She's
excited about the job.
Yeah, I really liked it.
Good. Great. And energy. She looks like...
And she's a nurse.
Yeah.
And the nurses that have been going around championing Bernie all year, all of them have been good. It seems like the right background in which to get people to care about people. So I think this is going to be great. And many of them he shared with Mark Haas, I got corrected in his office.
Oh, really?
I even look at his name, and it's A-S-S. And I don't even see the first S as an S. It comes across as A-A-S. And I say the wrong thing. So, anyway, they used to have many of their meetings together. They have a joint talking.
Yeah.
I am looking at your earrings. They are very interesting.
Chinese.
I wonder. Whatever, they're beautiful. Cool. Yeah, they are. They're very cool. I noticed things like that.
Are you coming on December 3rd?
I am planning to. I got to get it on the calendar. I just agreed to type up the email list for Laura. That's in place of doing databasing like they haven't been doing for a while. That is databasing. Anyway, she's going to send it to me in probably a photocopy of the handwritten thing. And I want to get that done this weekend, if possible, so that if and when this thing with the agency ever materializes, I'm ready to go. So
leaving that out of the way that we can. Get everything out of the way we can.
And then they're also investing the rest.
Yeah. So anyway, that's gonna send it to me. She's on me as an unlikely suspect, so that's fine.
Yeah.
I have been doing databases for a while, so I have extra time on my hands.
Republican,
that
was running for governor before.
That's right.
Dennis Richardson.
Yeah, Dennis Richardson. That's it.
But he was also running for governor this time.
No. He was running
for governor.
Yeah.
And he won over Tobias? That was nuts.
Well, yeah, it is, but it did.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I guess his background is in the county.
Oh, which would make anybody who didn't know Tobias wouldn't say, well, that's not as important as his values and beliefs.
Right.
Because you can learn the accounting stuff. Yeah, that's bad.
Where does the stands for?
Well, okay, you ready to get the... Did you say we were doing a dinner round?
No. You think we're done?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know.
Well, then put it.
He'd be leaving. I was just telling Mark that he did a much better job of explaining power math.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, he's the one who taught me how to do it.
I did three recently, and I was really impressed with the quality of the three legislators in particular.
Are we not regathering after that?
I think we cleaned up the whip. We completely cleaned up by 9:15.
Oh. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Yeah. Progress on the methane presentation.
I think it's going pretty good. I've got we did a presentation for Southwest.
Oh, good.
And that went really well.
Wonderful.
And
were you using the same basic?
That was a little piece of it. It extended it a bunch. There's a bunch of context.
How long did you have to do that?
I shot for 40 minutes and took about 45.
Okay, that's good. So I included a Q&A?
Not much of a Q&A. Yeah. What I did is collected cards, and I'm going to put the answers online. One, three, four, five, one, two.
So Rick, where do we take this?
One more. You want a place to go?
Yeah. Well, the answer is like
a lot of different places.
Like,
right. Yeah.
You can tune your channel to feed you all the events.
Okay.
Then you'll just start to see more of the other.
If this is winter, we're in great.
It's going to get a little cold. Anyway, so I'll look for that.
Yeah.
And I'll get back to you as quickly as I can.
So where are you
going?
Philadelphia.
Oh, you're going to see your family?
I'm going to see my family.
I'm going to have a family.
And then mostly in South.
My brother still lives in Germantown.
Wow.
Yeah, so every once in a while we get out there, and we went for my, because of course I have college and high school reunions that happen out there. And we had my 50th high school one in a couple of years ago. And that was the last time I saw my brother.
I come out for the reunions and then I visit family.
We always allow an extra couple days to stay with my brother and his family. And in a good year, I bring him. Actually, Ed helped me with them a lot.
Good.
So I put both names on the tag.
Yeah, I haven't done that much myself.
Well, you guys are just in the room.
I think this is going this way.
I'm going to find the bathroom.
Okay. I'm going to cuddle with Rick about these guys. I don't know.
Oh, all right. You sure you don't want to make, since this one's free, you want to put it over there?
Rick knows, I guess he was here early on.
He has a sense of the overall foreplay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I thought I'd already been told there was one in each of these.
Oh,
know,
okay.
So sort of a V.
Oh, okay, great. Well, let's do that.
Okay, I need food that's just like left over and done with.
Well, people.
What else do you want to do?